All right, I'll call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We're holding remote hearings pursuant to House Rule 10.01. A couple of reminders for folks, since it's still the first week of session and our first week of committees, that we ask that you default to being on mute and that you use the raise hand function on the reactions bar at the bottom of your screen if you would like to be recognized. Let's see, waiting for staff to tell me if we have a quorum. Today we'll be having two presentations. We won't be moving any bills today. One thing I do want to make sure that we take care of is I believe we have Mary Mullen, one of our nonpartisan staff, who was not with us on Tuesday. So Mary, if you could take a minute just to introduce yourself and let the committee know which areas you will be handling for research.
Do that. There we go. Morning. I'm Mary Mullen from House Research. I work on the Civil Law Committee. I do family law and also a lot of things that we classify under the category of torts. So civil liability issues, constitutional issues, and human rights issues. I also staff the Housing Committee and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund for the Legacy.
All right, thank you very much, Mary. We do have a quorum, and so we will get started here. We first thing order of business will be approval of the minutes from January 12th. Vice Chair Moeller, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Moeller. I'm looking to see if we have any questions or additions to the minutes. Does not look like we do. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. With that, we do have a quorum now, and so we will move to the call of the roll. Anna, if you could please go forward with calling the roll.
Hey, Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
And I see Representative Herr is just joining us. Hi. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
And Representative Herr.
Present.
All right. Thank you, Anna, and thank you, everybody, for being here bright and early at 8:33 in the morning. One thing we're going to do today is members should have received a copy of the committee rules via email. I'm not going to read them to you. You all can read, but I will hit a couple highlights here as far as we're going to begin meetings on time. We do ask people to join Zoom a couple minutes early to make sure that we've got you connected. We expect folks to attend all meetings, but if you are unable to attend, please let Anna, our CLA, and Rachel, our committee administrator, know. I'm not going to be asking for doctor's notes or anything, but we just like to know ahead of time if you could let staff know if you are unable to attend, you'll be marked as excused. We are going to follow regular procedures as far as speaking through the chair and following respectful decorum. Testifiers and bill authors, for our lobbyists and other folks watching at home, we do ask that any written materials be provided in the correct format to our staff. For remote hearings, we'll take voice votes on everything unless a roll call is requested or we are moving legislation. Requests, basically read the rules. Everything has to go through our CA so that we know what's going on. And especially since we aren't able to, stop by in person and check on folks, just keep that communication going with our staff. The of more importance as we move forward when we're moving more bills, the deadline for amendments will be 10 a.m. the day before. I did want to give folks a little bit of time as an 8:30 meeting. Didn't want to do that 24-hour period, you know, give you a little bit of time when you wake up in the morning for staff to get things drafted if there are requests right away in the morning. And everything else is in the rules. I think one of the only other things that's a little bit different that might not be stated explicitly in some of the other committees that you're on is that if anyone from the public, testifiers, people on this committee require any kind of interpreter or ADA accommodation, we will do all that we can to meet those accommodations. We just ask that you put those requests in as soon as possible to our committee administrator so we can try to make things work to make things as accessible to everybody who might want to know what's going on and participate in our committee. And with that, like I said, please read the rules. And if you do have questions, you can follow up with me afterwards, or if we've got time at the very end today, we can get into some discussion. But we have some really important presentations today, and I want to make sure members have the opportunity to ask questions during those presentations. And so our first presentation will be from the public defenders. So I'm waiting for staff to just let me know that they're in the Zoom room with us. I see at least one of them. So I think we're good to go. So welcome to our committee. And please identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent. I believe we have Chief Administrator and the State Public Defender, Bill Ward, with us today. So I'm not sure which one of you is going to start. So if you guys just want to go ahead with your presentation and we'll go from there. And I will remind our presenters as well that you have to take yourself off mute. Staff aren't going to do that for you. So that will be our goal, to make it through a committee without me having to remind you that you're muted. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to come in front of the committee. My name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. Excuse me. Somewhere in cyberspace, I believe Bill Ward, our State Public Defender, is also in the meeting.
Madam Chair, I am present.
Yep. There we go. So, Madam Chair, can you see this? I've got the split screen up. Can you see the document I'm working off of? Can everybody see that?
I'm not seeing it.
Okay. That's, I'm seeing it, but, and I know we had it up before with Rachel. In any event, everyone has the document, I believe, anyway, so I'll start to go through it.
Yep, and I'll just remind members of the committee that it was emailed from Rachel Ganani. All these attachments for today were emailed to you, so we'll work on it, on getting it up and running, but I don't want to waste committee time figuring that out, so we'll have you go ahead, Mr. Kyer, and in the meantime, if folks want to go to their email and pull that up, they're able to do that.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and members, just as a little background, both our federal and state constitutions provide that anyone charged with an offense that's punished by loss of liberty is entitled to representation by a lawyer. The most famous of those cases is the Gideon case. In Justice Black's opinion on that case, he mentioned and referred that lawyers in criminal cases are necessities, not luxuries. In Minnesota, it's the Board of Public Defense that is charged with providing that service. The board is an independent agency within the judicial branch. We have four attorney members appointed by the Supreme Court. We have three non-attorney members that are appointed by the governor. The duties of the board are outlined in Minnesota Statute 611.215. The board sets standards and policies. It appoints our district chief public defenders, our chief appellate defender, and our state public defender, and also allocates funding from the legislature. The board is organized into three programs: our district public defense, that is the defense services on our trial court level; the appellate office, which provides the services at the Court of Appeals and the State Supreme Court; in our administrative services office. There we go. Oh, somebody's doing something. We have five major goals. Continual training for all staff, creative advocacy, client-centered representation, being a full partner in the justice system, and the recruitment and retention of excellent staff. I'm on, for who's ever now got the controls, I'm on slide number seven. On the district public defense level, we provide constitutionally mandated services in felonies, gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, and delinquencies. Minnesota statutes also provide that children over 10 in child protection cases are afforded an attorney, and we provide that service. In the appellate office, the office provides constitutionally mandated services in criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings. These are things like sentencings, issues around guilty pleas, and then supervised release proceedings, or what we used to call parole revocation hearings. The board also administers funding for four public defense corporations under the district defense program. These are statutorily mandated funding that go to these nonprofit corporations. They handle anywhere between 3,000 and 4,000 cases a year that, but for them, would be public defender cases. They are the Minneapolis Legal Rights Center, the St. Paul Neighborhood Justice Center, Duluth Indian Legal Services, and the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, which serves the White Earth and Leech Lake communities. We have on the district level, on slide number 10, we have 9 district offices. We have 18 satellite offices, and we have 180 part-time public defenders around the state. And we'll talk about those in a little bit, because they are really a vital piece of our service provision, particularly in greater Minnesota. The budget is for this year is just over $100 million. You can see from the slide about just over 90% of that is district public defense, almost 7% in the appellate office, and about 3% in the administrative services office. Of the budget, you will hear me talk about this over and over again until you're sick of it. The budget is 90% personnel. About 6% is what we call mandated costs. Those are things like rent, data lines, mileage. Our public defenders put on about 1 million miles a year in going to and from court or to and from the jails. It's obviously been less this year. Phones, just things that you can think of, kind of fixed costs, if you will. When we are fully staffed, and I must say, use that caveat, is when we're fully staffed. Right now, we are down 53 lawyers, 69 total staff. When we are fully staffed, we are at 859 total staff, 553 assistant public defenders. The reason we are down right now is we did institute a hiring freeze back in March when we saw what the budget situation you all were facing was going to be. And we didn't think it was very prudent to start hiring folks or continue to hire folks given that budget situation. We have now started to put the advertisements out, put the postings out to start at least hiring some of those folks back, particularly in the 7th, 8th, and 9th districts, which is, for those of you new, is basically St. Cloud up to the Canadian border, and then west to the North and South Dakota border. We had quite a few staff openings there, and again, we just weren't able to cover everything we needed to cover. So, as I mentioned before, about a third of our assistant public defenders are part-time. When you look at the staffing on slide 14, it shows kind of our staffing and our staffing ratios. Those are our the paralegals, investigators, legal secretaries, assistants, and our dispositional advisors are our support staff, if you will. So those are the non-attorney staff that we have. I mentioned the part-timers because they are a huge part of our service providing, primarily in Greater Minnesota, although not exclusively. They are state employees, so they have access to state benefits, state insurance benefits, which is a huge, huge deal for us. They work, or I shouldn't say they work, because they work much more than this, but they are classified as 75% time, 50% time, or 25% time. They take whatever cases are assigned or whatever calendars they are assigned to. They're paid on a lump sum biweekly basis. It's not hourly. And they cover their own office overhead. We do provide a small stipend for them on an annual basis. It's just over $5,000 a year for a 75% time defender, and about $3,800, excuse me, for a 50% time defender. Those of you who practice, that are attorneys of practice, you know that comes nowhere close to covering what the overhead is for you as a lawyer. The board is the largest user of the court system. In a normal year, and again, this past year obviously is anything but normal, or has been, we handle 147,000 cases on the trial level, about almost 10,000 cases, or a little over 9,000 cases in the appellate office, between appellate files, supervised release, and some of the other things that they do. We provide mandated service in every county and every courtroom in the state. It's important to note, Madam Chair and members, and you've heard me talk about this before, those of you who have been on the committee, public defenders cannot refuse cases. We have two Minnesota State Supreme Court cases that outline that. You've heard me use this analogy before, but frankly, I think it's a good one, which is in the days when we were driving to the Capitol, if there are 20 potholes and the Department of Transportation only has funding to fill 15 of them, we swerve around the other five. If our lawyers have 20 clients in their office or in jail or in the courthouse waiting to be heard and waiting for their case, they don't have the luxury of saying, I'm going to take 12 or 15 of you and the rest of you, we're going to take some other time or somebody else is going to. They don't have that ability. At the same time, our lawyers are held to the same ethical standards as private attorneys, and they should be. These are three of the more recent U.S. Supreme Court cases which outline some of those rights or some of those obligations. Particularly in plea negotiations, and also one that's become much more prevalent is immigration consequences and the collateral consequences that come with a conviction. On the district defense level, we opened roughly, as I said, 147,000 cases. About two-thirds of those are gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor cases. When you break this down, which we do, into what we call a case unit, which is roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor, the actual workload, if you will, about 35% of it is felony work. About 30% is gross misdemeanor, and when we talk about others, it's extraditions, cases like that. So about two-thirds of it is really kind of those serious, either felony or gross misdemeanor cases in terms of workload. I know it's not a budget hearing, Madam Chair, but I did want to at least put the slide in, just kind of give some perspective is where we're at versus the state and national standards for public defender staffing. Obviously, as we talk about the budget, we'll talk some more about that. But just to give folks a kind of a perspective of where we're at, based on those standards. As we mentioned in one of the previous slides, the workloads and caseloads are controlled by outside factors, and there are a number of challenges that we have. And then now going on 10 years ago, the Office of the Legislative Auditor identified high public defender workloads as creating significant challenges for Minnesota's criminal justice system. I think things have improved since then, but certainly when you talk to the judges around the state and when you talk to other folks, is we are kind of seen as kind of some of the problem in terms of a resource allocation. And I know clearly since we've had our hiring freeze, that has been the case. The judges and the court have been very understanding about that. At the same time, they also recognize what a problem it is. Challenges. Obviously, as everyone is dealing with, is the COVID-19 situation.
And actually, Kevin, I'm going to stop you there just since we're partway through. Before we move on to this section, I just want to make sure members, if you do have questions about what's been covered so far, please use the raise hand function. I want to make sure that we're keeping everybody paying attention and making sure that this is a discussion and folks' questions are being answered as much as possible. Kevin and Mr. Ward, I'm sure you noticed we have quite a few new members on this committee who maybe haven't seen this presentation or a similar presentation before. So I do want to give members an opportunity if they do have questions. Otherwise, there will be more chances to ask questions, certainly when you're done. So not seeing anybody raising their hand though. So, okay. You must be doing a great job.
Lost everybody, Madam Chair.
Yeah, maybe. it is early for some of us.
And I know it is difficult. We've been doing this, obviously quite a bit in our own organization and particularly with our board. It's been a challenge. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and I'll remind folks too, you know, if, you know, this is a lot to cover. There were a lot of Supreme Court cases referenced, a lot of information referenced, and I'm sure that all of our testifiers today, if folks have questions or want to meet separately with you afterwards for follow-up, that also is an option as people are digesting this information.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. We've started that process already, so we've met with a few of you, and we will continue to do that because we know it's a lot, you know, especially in this era where it's, you know, you can't meet in person. And so we will definitely do that.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. As I mentioned, everybody's dealing with this. How do we keep our folks safe? How do we work remotely? I will tell you, we have a very small tech staff, but they did an unbelievable job in getting roughly 700 people working remotely in about 4 days. It was just incredible. I don't know that they slept any of that time, but it was unbelievable. We are encountering some issues, particularly in Greater Minnesota with bandwidth, you know, those issues. And again, that's nothing new, especially to those of you who are from those areas. But it actually has gone all right. It's actually gone fairly well. Things are taking a much longer time. Where we are appearing in person, and make no mistake, if we have clients who are in jail, if we have clients who are in court, our folks are there and they have an ethical obligation to be there. But things are taking longer just in terms of moving people around, the social distancing. The court has done a terrific job in terms of certifying their courtrooms about being safe. But as you all found out, I think in your own daily lives, things are just take longer. The other piece is getting discovery and documents to clients in jail, which is another issue that we've had. And again, it's not that we haven't had cooperation from the sheriffs, but it's just in this era, in this pandemic, those are some of the things that are challenging.
And Mr. Kyer, we do have a question from Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Kaya, for being here. Thank you, Chief Ward, for being here as well. Hey, quick question. In the 9th district, I know that's a large district. How many staffed public defenders do we have in that district?
Mr. Kaya.
Madam Chair and Representative Frazier, I believe we are at 40 lawyers. Now, they're not all full-time. So it's right around there. Now, again, we're down about 25% of our lawyers in that district right now. So we don't have that full staff right now.
And Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. And just a follow-up, since we moved remotely, do you have numbers in terms of attendance, in terms of clients showing up or being more clients showing up at a higher rate than they were before we moved to remote?
State Public Defender Bill Ward might have some more information on that, or might have some insight.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, the actual amount of warrants that have been issued is less now during the COVID than it was previously. The difficulty, as Mr. Kaya mentioned, is the attendance is actually good. The difficulty is broadband length, or width, I should say, and way too many of our clients are having to go to places like outside the McDonald's parking lot to access Wi-Fi in order to have a better streaming to attend their hearings. But as I understand it from the courts, that warrants having been issued in the past, it's less during COVID than it was previously.
Representative Frazier, any follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative. And you can go ahead with your presentation.
Madam Chair, the next challenge that we're dealing with is the increased use of audio and video. And again, I want to say, as we go down this list of these challenges, we're not suggesting at all that these are bad things. We're not suggesting at all that they shouldn't be done. What we want to lay out is that all of these things kind of impact the criminal justice system one way or the other. And one thing that, and I know you all have struggled with it as well, is the use of audio and video. We have a pilot program we started in Ramsey County back in September, having our content management system download audio and video, because prior to that, we weren't taking it. Since that time, we've downloaded the equivalent of 250 full-length movies. What used to be a situation where an attorney would be reviewing statements from the folks involved, from witnesses, reviewing the police reports, now includes review of maybe multiple, either body cams, dashboard cams, retail security cameras, traffic cameras, whatever it might be. So it's not only a time issue for our lawyers, but also, again, a cost in terms of storing all of that, the bandwidth, again, as we mentioned. It's something we're struggling with. It won't be part of this year's budget request, but we did want to make it aware. It is one of the challenges we're dealing with, and as I know a lot of people are. So. The next one is scientific evidence. This includes drug analysis and chemicals, electronics, DNA. Particularly on the DNA evidence, if you look at the next slide, is what we've been seeing is, and these notations are somewhat old, but they haven't gone away at all, is what we've seen is this increased use of DNA evidence and touch DNA, using it on property crimes. I like the two quotes that are in here. These are from the Tri-County lab up in the Anoka County area. As of right now, we are pretty much testing everything. And if you can think of it, we've probably tested it. Our folks have to look through that. They have to analyze it for the ways in which it was collected. The ways it was processed, the ways it's analyzed, and obviously the way it's reported. So that is another one of the challenges that we are facing. We're dealing with it, but it is contributing to taking more time and more effort in a lot of these cases. The electronic forensics, again, you all are struggling with this in terms of how and when. You know, we had a conversation yesterday, and you know, that phone that you're carrying probably contains more information about you than anything you have in your house. Anything, a desk, files, whatever it might be. We are seeing a lot more of this as we go along. Madam Chair, clients with chemical dependency issues. Again, this is nothing new. You know, these numbers, again, are somewhat dated. But again, I don't know that they've gone away at all. I don't know that they've gone down at all. Our defenders will tell you the number one issue they deal with is chemical dependency, both the clients who are chemically dependent, either when they're committing the crime, either when they're in court, when they're dealing with them. It's just that's what it is. If you look at that top bullet, that was a Minnesota Department of Health or Human Services report. 80 to 90% of criminal cases have some kind of element of chemical dependency or addiction being a factor. Along with that is mental health issues. Again, we have seen folks in jail, a third to maybe even more to 50% of folks who are in our county jails, in our prisons, are struggling with mental health issues. I know the sheriffs have talked to a number of you about this. These are the same folks that we're dealing with. So it's another issue that we are dealing with, not only with clients, but also in the courtroom in terms of their certifications as well. Language and cultural barriers. As we get more diverse, not only language, but cultural differences. What do things mean in different cultures? Because there are differences. My sister-in-law taught in the Minneapolis public schools for 30 some years. When she left a couple of years ago, she told me there were 80 some languages that were spoken in the Minneapolis public schools, which was just amazing. That was incredible. And it's just not Minneapolis. Obviously, as we're getting more diverse in a lot of the other areas around the state, this is an issue again, just in terms of the time it takes. Do we need interpreters? You know, are folks really understanding what our folks are telling them? And are we understanding what they're telling our folks? And so that's a struggle. Federal and state local funding decisions. Again, we're not here to say these are bad things. We're not here to say that they shouldn't be done. But when these are done, when there are additional prosecutors added, when we additional judges, either retired judges or judgeships, or we do the warrant sweeps, we're already, as you saw on this previous slides, is we're already understaffed, and now all of a sudden we're going to get three more prosecutors for drunk driving enforcement, which again is great. Nobody wants to be involved in that, but those are three additional calendars then, or three additional prosecutors we deal with, additional court calendars that somehow we have to staff. And lastly, on this, in terms of the challenges, Madam Chair, the collateral consequences. We have over 200 collateral consequences in state statute. These obviously complicate cases. It complicates what people are willing to do in their cases, what our lawyers have to be up on in terms of those collateral consequences. We've talked about this before with folks, is it impacts things like student loans, housing, licensure, a whole host of these things. So again, those are things that you know, even 15 years ago, let's say, if defenders didn't have to worry quite as much about. So, Madam Chair, I mentioned our electronic content management system. The next slide, we have had a case management system for a number of years, talking about or keeping track of time, clients, assignments, all of those things, obviously. The content management system, we launched a couple of years ago with just taking Word documents, PDF documents. And now, as I said, we've been kind of pushed into the audio and video world, and we're going down that path. But it's got some issues of its own, right? Licensure costs, because everybody who uses it has to have a license for each of the software applications. Again, bandwidth, I mentioned, and again, the storage issues. Again, we're not saying it's not a good thing. We're not saying we shouldn't be doing it. We need to do it. But it's just something I will tell you that we never thought of even 15 years ago that would be one of the major things we'd be dealing with. In our office here, we have four people that run this organization, two of which are on the phone with or on the video with you. But we have eight tech staff. You know, that number was reversed, you know, as little as 10 years ago. And frankly, if Bill and I were not to end up showing up for work for the next year or whatever it might be due to whatever circumstances, people would get along without us. I'm not sure that would be the case without the tech staff. Finally, Madam Chair, I think the board has been a good steward of public funds. 95% of our budget is direct service to clients. 90% of the board staff provides direct service to clients. And our last slide, I just wanted to show is that you have the two maps there. Back when we had our really severe budget reductions back in 2008, 2009, and 2010, we weren't able to cover first appearances. We made a commitment, and frankly, the legislature and the governor made a commitment that this was something that was important to do, to get back into. You can see in the color, counties colored in yellow and orange. The yellow is where we were not at first appearance at all. The orange is where we were there at first appearance occasionally. And that was 2014. The title on that map on the right, where it's all blue, is a little bit, it's a little older. It's actually 2018. When we are fully staffed, we are now at first appearances on those in custody cases in all of those blue counties. Morrison County is actually orange now, as is, I believe, Redwood County is also orange. But the other counties, by and large, are just too small to have folks there, you know, all the time. But I bring it up because it is a commitment we made. It's a commitment you all made, and obviously the governor made. And we just wanted to show that we're doing what we told you we were going to do. So with that, we would obviously, Madam Chair, stand for any questions you or members of the committee might have.
Yep, and thank you, Mr. Kier. And we do have a question from Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I spent a little time in a public defender's office, and I'm a strong supporter of public defense and the hard work that our public defenders do around the state. My questions today are around pay equity. I'm very concerned for public defenders in Hennepin County in particular. There's a substantial pay gap for public defenders and prosecutors in Hennepin County. It's about $10,000 to start, and it can grow over time to $20,000 or $30,000 gaps. And I think that really sends the wrong message about what we value in our criminal justice system. I personally have friends who've left to become prosecutors, not because they wanted to, but because they had student loans to pay. And I also have friends who've left to go to the county because they can make about $10,000 more at the county than working as a public defender. So that means we're losing out on really good talent every single year. So I would like to know what steps the board has taken to try to help create salary parity with Hennepin County public defenders.
Mr. Kier.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Long, we certainly understand that. You will recall that 2 years ago, we did come to the legislature with a funding request to start making some steps in that direction. It's a very expensive proposition. And I think we've closed the gap somewhat. Our entry level salary is now $63,800. So we have closed that gap somewhat. I would mention that this isn't, and you mentioned it, it's just not a Hennepin County issue. It is a number of the counties, particularly the metro counties, but also Olmsted County, Stearns County, St. Louis County, all pay more than we can. So it is a problem. It is an issue. We'll talk more about it in the budget presentation. But those are the things we're doing to try to close that gap. But we can't do it all at one time. It's a very expensive proposition to do.
Actually, Madam Chair.
Mr. Ward.
The starting salary now is actually $66,000 for new lawyer. But I will also tell you that, and this is difficult for people to understand, the state benefits are substantial that the board provides too. So it's not just the salary. For us to have a family on the payroll, it costs us $27,000 as an agency to provide benefits. So the reality is it's not just the starting salary. I agree with you 100%, Representative Long. We've had this discussion in the past. It is our goal and desire to raise these salaries. I mean, we're falling behind not just counties, but the city attorney's office in Minneapolis, the Rochester city attorney's office, Beltrami County. I mean, so it's not just a Hennepin County issue. It's a statewide issue that we're grappling with. And in these difficult times, we hope to make some progress, but it's not that it's not isn't recognized by the board at all.
Representative Long, any follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Curious if I know that the state budget has been a challenge. Have you all approached the county to see if they would be willing to help in making up some of the differential?
Mr. Kier or Mr. Ward?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, the employees in the office are state employees. And so it's our responsibility or the state's responsibility to be paying them.
Representative Long.
Counties are in a tough position as well, economically, as you know. So.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that you mentioned the hiring freeze, and I know that there were five new attorneys in Hennepin County this year who were made offers to and then put on hold given the budget concerns. It's my understanding that Hennepin County offered to pay for those five attorneys to be brought on, at least for a temporary basis until the budget concerns could have been addressed, but that was rejected by the board, and I'm curious why you were unwilling to accept the county's help in that circumstance.
Mr. Ward.
Representative Long, Madam Chair, and members, that just isn't true. I would suggest that if you talk to the chief administrator for Hennepin County, David Huff, you would have a different insight on that. We had a long discussion with them. The question became ultimately costs of unemployment if they were laid off and a number of other issues that we had to deal with. So those five are now on staff, or they will begin, I believe, next week. So they will be on staff.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I checked with Hennepin County before I asked the question, so my sources are good, but I'm glad to hear that they're hired. I was disappointed that that the county's help was refused, and I hope that in the future that would be something you all would consider. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. And I will, as a tip to our presenters, when you do come back for the budget presentation, I just want to make sure folks know that the services that public defenders provide are something that are mandated constitutionally that we give to folks. And so to keep that in mind,
as you put together your presentation and what those requests are, that that is a factor that is certainly being looked at by myself and other leaders in this area, as opposed to some of the other things that we may want to fund. But, you know, this is a really a case of a constitutional right that needs to be supported, and it's our duty to do that. So don't want folks to hold back on what is actually needed to do the work that needs to be done. And with that, we've got a couple other questions. Next up is Representative Liebling.
Yeah, good morning, everybody, and hello to Mr. Kier and Mr. Ward. My question really kind of goes along with Representative Long's question, and it has to do with Mr. Kier, you presented a slide about what happens when other parts of our system, our criminal justice system, grow and we don't keep up on the public defense side. And I know that for many years there have been conversations about caseload and, you know, how do we figure out how many public defenders we actually need in different places. And I'm wondering if there's been any, if there's any data about how many public defenders you need for each unit of some other unit of the criminal justice system. So for, and I know there are a lot of factors involved, as you talked about, it's not just one prosecutor per how many public defenders, but my question is, are there any sort of metrics that we can use to say how much of our system should be public defenders as opposed to other pieces of the system, so that we can kind of judge as one part grows, what do we need to be looking at on the other side?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I don't know, and Mr. Ward might have some insight on this as well. I don't know that there's a ratio, if you will, to prosecutors. We'd love to see 1-to-1, of course, but there is a standard, a weighted caseload standard that we use that a number of jurisdictions have used in terms of determining how many cases can a public defender handle, how many should be assigned to them in a given year, right? And one of the previous slides you saw, we're at when we're fully staffed, we're at about 75% of what that standard should be. I don't have the number on the top of my head, but it would be a significant number of new attorneys that we would need to get to that 100% level. You know, given where we were, and again, I know this isn't the budget discussion, but given where we were putting this budget together last fall and where you all were facing, what we were facing in terms of a potential budget disaster, let's be honest, it didn't seem really prudent to be asking for a lot of new lawyers at that time, and it's frankly where we don't know what's going to be the case on the other side, right? Once we get through this and we get through the backlog of cases, you know, our charging pattern is going to be the same. Our you know, our court system is going to be the same. We just don't know. So that's, I know it's a longer answer than maybe you wanted, but there is a standard, yes.
Any follow-up, Representative Chair, if I may. Oh, Mr. Ward.
You know, there have been studies done on various states throughout the United States, including Missouri, Louisiana, and Colorado. And the metrics that were used by putting together a committee as to what the public defenders believed, how many hours it would take to handle certain areas of cases, certain types of case types, and what private attorneys would believe how much time was involved. The standards that Mr. Kier referred to are called the NAC standards. They've been around for a long, long time. There are those who would tell you that based upon the changes in technology and based upon the consequences of criminal convictions, that those standards are too high. There's a group, the National Association for Public Defenders, that I'm a member of, that our agency is a member of, that are looking at those standards and looking at caseload numbers versus workload. And as we move forward in our agency, and timekeeping becomes an issue that is important to us, how much time are we actually spending on cases? And unless and until we actually we do increments of 6 minutes or 10 minutes on, you know, and how we're using our time, we're not going to know exactly how much time we're spending on each case. But versus, you know, using the existing standards now for budgetary presentations, for instance. So again, you know, with forensics, with the amount of data that we're looking at, you know, in the old days, you know, I hate to say it, a simple domestic, you know, quote unquote simple domestic involved a you know, police responding, a report, interviewing of the complainant, and potential interview of the client. Well, now, depending on the jurisdiction or municipality, you could have 5 body cameras that are there. You know, so there's a lot more work that goes involved that it's involved in any case that we handle right now. So as time moves on, it'll be prudent upon us and other agencies as well to make a real determination as the time needed to represent the cases.
Any follow-up, Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you for that. And that, yeah, that's helpful. And I hope that as if there's, I think it would be very important to have real data. And I realize how hard that could be to get, but real data to tell us where we should be. And even if we're not anywhere near that, or, you know, just to know, to have some kind of data benchmark. And so I hope you'll keep us informed if you believe there's a way we can help participate in getting that data or getting a metric or, you know, something that for the future, even if it doesn't, you know, help us immediately, something that'll help get us into a position where we can be more data driven about what the real need is, so that we, at least if we're failing, we know we're failing. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Liebling. And I will note we've got 3 people on the list and we still have a presentation from Civil Legal Aid. So if we could keep our questions focused, that would be very much appreciated by everybody. Representative Frazier, you're next up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep it brief. Mr. Kerr and Mr. Ward, you mentioned that the increases to a starting attorney now is about the amount is about $66,000. Is that, and is it true that that is what the what an interim attorney for the PD's office would get around the state?
Correct.
Mr. Kier.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, correct. That's.
So for example, an attorney in Hennepin County, and for example, an attorney that would work in Stevens County would get the same amount.
Madam Chair, Mr. Frazier, that's
yep,
correct.
Mr. Kier. Okay.
Thank you. So my question to that, I mean, obviously you can see in terms of the equity issue, right? I mean, in Stevens County, it's a lot lower cost of living to live in Stevens County, a county I used to live in, and now I live in Hennepin County. So I personally know that. So my concern is I know around the country, there are places where public defenders' offices, every 3 to 4 years, they get an entire new batch of attorneys. That means inexperienced attorneys working with clients that need help the most. I need some zealous and informed, experienced, passionate advocates. My concern is I don't want our public defender's office to turn into that. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll have more questions when you all return with the budget discussion.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Next up is Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this brief too. I couldn't help but be struck by some of the presentation here, that 1 in 4 people in the U.S. have a criminal record. And I saw that asterisk down the bottom of that slide that said, we are all criminals. So my question, I don't know if this data is available, but if it could be brought forward, is there data available on what offenses most often require public defenders?
Mr. Kier or Mr. Ward.
Madam Chair, anyone who has a loss of freedom is entitled to a public defender. So misdemeanor through felony. If you charge with a petty offense, you're not provided with free counsel. And children over 10 and older in CHIPS cases are provided free counsel. On the criminal side, you have to be eligible to be appointed a lawyer for my office, which if you make any means tested income, you would be eligible. And or depending on what kind of occupation you have and what your liabilities are. So, you know, everybody is entitled if, in fact, they're charged with a crime and their freedom is at stake.
Representative Mortensen.
Right. I guess I understand that. But my question is there data available in this case management system that we could get our hands on to say the largest percent of public defenders demand, if you will, goes towards these particular types of offenses? Because I think this is one area that that I would be in unity with people on the other side of the aisle that I think looking at some decriminalization makes a lot of sense.
Madam Chair, I would agree. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, felony matters take a lot more time depending on if there's any scientific evidence, depending on the investigation that's done, depending on the investigation that was done prior to charging. I will say this, and I mean this wholeheartedly, when I was a young lawyer, to me, the felonies were the most serious. I don't believe that anymore because a misdemeanor with collateral consequences is just as serious because folks can't get, you know, appropriate, occupation, job hunting, housing, student loans, that sort of thing. So every case is as serious. And the fact of the matter is because of the volume that we're faced with, we tend to spend less time in misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors than we do on felonies. And that's just because of the squeeze. It's not a matter of choice. It's because of the squeeze.
Representative Mortensen.
Sure. I guess my goal and what I promised my constituents, and I know we don't all share this, but how do we focus on cost containment? And I think a great way to focus on cost containment would be, how do we look at some of these things that are considered offenses now that are nonviolent, and how do we make some of these things go away so that we take that caseload away? And so I guess I would still be curious to get some information on suggestions for starting points.
Yep. Thank you. And we can certainly, if there is information that the board can provide to us, we can get that sent out to members as well. And I'm sure this will continue to be something that we discuss moving forward this session. So thank you for your comments. And last, we have Representative Feist, and then we'll go to the legal aid presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Speakers, I was curious. I was really struck by the slide pertaining to clients with mental health issues. And I was curious about how mental health services and interventions intersect with the services you provide, whether people are acquitted or convicted. Because to follow up on Representative Mortensen's comments about cost containment, it just seems like if we were providing more mental health services that we could stop people from getting involved in the criminal justice system in the first place. So thank you.
Yep. And I will say both myself and Vice Chair Bowler serve on the Behavioral Health Policy Committee as well. So certainly that topic is top of mind for us as well. Mr. Kier or Mr. Ward, any response to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, I agree with you 100%. I've been involved in two committees over the course of the last 2 years, one of which was established by the courts, and that's regarding 2001 issues, competency issues, and sanity issues at the time of the offense. I'm the vice chair of the Community Competency Restoration Task Force that is ongoing still, that was legislatively created. Without doubt, if resources are provided in the community, including mental health, treatment and that sort of thing, but housing as well. If those resources were provided, we would divert people from coming into the system in the first place. My goal is always to keep people from coming into the system. Too many folks use the system to deal with issues, and mental health is one of those areas. And we are ill-equipped. The criminal court system is ill-equipped, in my opinion, to be handling these cases the way they should outside of the court system. So it's a long-term goal. The Community Competency Task Force, our report is due soon. We are making recommendations on how to handle things better if they get into the system, but without doubt, keeping them from coming into the system is by far the most important process.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. And with that, good questions, everybody. And as I mentioned, if folks have additional questions or you think of something later, please do follow up with our presenters. Want to thank you both for presenting today and providing that really helpful information, and we will see you again when it's budget time. And with that, we will move on to our next presentation, which I want to welcome to the committee. We have a presentation today from Civil Legal Services, and so we have Dory Streit and Drew Schaefer. And I don't know which one of you wants to start, but if you want to go ahead with your presentation, we are ready to hear it.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, Vice Chair Mohler, and to all members of the committee. We really appreciate the invitation to be here today to provide a very high-level overview about legal aid in Minnesota. My name is Drew Schaefer. I am the Executive Director at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, which is part of the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. And I'll turn it to Dori Streit to introduce herself briefly.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us. My name is Dori Streit. I'm the Executive Director of Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota.
So again, Dori and I really appreciate having the opportunity to be here to provide a high-level overview about legal aid. We are going to talk about who we are and what we do and how we deliver justice to people statewide in Minnesota. We're going to talk about our response to the COVID-19 pandemic and public health emergency. And we're going to field questions from you. And we expect to get through our presentation in about 20 minutes and to leave the balance of our time to answer your questions. So again, thanks for having us here.
So we'd like to start by talking about what is civil legal services or what is legal aid. The justice system was designed with lawyers in mind, not everyday people. Legal assistance is critical when seeking justice, but in civil types of cases, if you can't pay for a lawyer, then justice truly feels out of reach. When people must go to court because their most basic needs are at issue, legal aid is there to provide free legal assistance for those who can't pay for a lawyer. Legal aid helps divided families gain stability and obtain protection against abuse and violence. Legal aid ensures people can keep a roof over their head by preventing evictions and foreclosures. Legal aid helps individuals get access to healthcare, schools, employment, food. Legal aid ensures that access to justice is a right and not a privilege.
Legal aid makes the legal system a justice system for the families and individuals we serve. We are literally giving families statewide in Minnesota a chance at justice. There's a reason that nationally, 3 out of every 4 cases, one side or the other doesn't have an attorney. And that reason is there aren't enough resources to support legal representation for everybody who needs it in critical cases affecting people's most fundamental civil and human rights. Civil legal services in Minnesota is forced to turn away over half of the people who seek legal representation due to lack of resources. And to illustrate the point, in Minnesota, for every private attorney, there are 432 paying clients that could seek services from that attorney. But for people in Minnesota that are eligible for legal aid, there are over 5,700 of them for every legal aid attorney that could possibly help them. So that is why the support that we request from the legislature is so important to making Minnesota's legal system a justice system for the families and individuals we serve statewide.
We know that it's essential to maximize our limited resources. And so across the state of Minnesota, legal aid programs provide services to Minnesotans who meet certain eligibility guidelines. Our clients have poverty are at 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. Programs set priorities to ensure that our limited resources are being put to reach the most people as possible. So in order to do that, legal aid programs are representing people in court. We provide a significant amount of our time and resources in courtrooms, at administrative hearings, at negotiations, meeting with clients, and other forums where we are advocating on behalf of our clients. In some circumstances, the level of service that we can provide clients will be things like advice and counsel, or a brief service where we're helping clients complete forms that are complicated for them to do on their own. We provide this variety of services, again, so we can reach as many people as possible. We also work to maintain a suite of websites, including LawHelpMN and ProJusticeMN. ProJusticeMN is designed by Legal Aid to help support volunteer attorneys who help us in partnership meet the tremendous need of folks seeking help with their civil legal matters.
And how do we do this and have the statewide impact that we have? Well, you can see we have shared a map with you that shows with stars the locations of the field offices we have for our broad civil legal representation services in poverty law practice areas. Those offices are the offices of regional legal aid providers. There are six of us that touch all 87 counties and serve people statewide in Minnesota. In addition, part of our legal aid network includes targeted programs that are issue specific or geographically specific to meet specifically identified community needs in locations throughout the state. And so that is how we have the statewide impact we have with this network of nonprofit civil legal aid providers.
So a little bit more about who we serve. As we've discussed, we're providing statewide services to low-income Minnesotans, but more specifically, the demographics of our clients ensure that we have diversity, equity, and inclusion as core values of what we do at Civil Legal Services, central to our cause for access, equal access, and justice for all. Legal aid provides access to justice primarily for populations who have disproportionate numbers of people in poverty. This includes Black, Indigenous, and people of color, people with disabilities, senior citizens, the LGBTQ community, and veterans. Every year at Legal Aid, we review the aggregate number of cases closed amongst all the programs that Drew just discussed. And we, in 2019, closed 44,920 cases, which directly served 112,433 Minnesotans. As you can see on our slide here, 60% of the clients served by Legal Aid were Black, Indigenous, or people of color.
The state appropriation that we will be sharing with you, our request for the upcoming biennium at a later time in this session, is very important to support the justice we deliver to Minnesotans statewide. The chart that is before you on the slide shows just how important the state appropriation is. So presently, in the current fiscal year, Civil Legal Services receives $14.72 million in funding from the legislature. And that is 32% of the complete resource environment that supports the justice that we deliver in Minnesota. But you can see that we leverage the investments that are made by the state in legal aid with other funding sources that help us to do a lot more work in all parts of the state and to meet the needs of the communities we serve. The Legal Services Advisory Committee is a committee of the judicial branch that administers the legislative funding. And additionally, the Legal Services Advisory Committee administers small parts of the funding that come from attorney registration fees and interest on lawyer trust accounts. In total, it's about $18.5 million that's administered by the Legal Services Advisory Committee to invest in legal aid work around the state. So that gives you a picture of the funding, the critical piece of the funding that is represented by the legislative appropriation. And we will be looking forward to sharing more information about our specific request when we come back before you later in the session.
I'm going to shift gears and focus a bit on Civil Legal Services' response to the pandemic. In March of 2020, as we all remember, there was a very sudden and rapid instruction to move everybody to virtual environments to ensure the safety of all Minnesotans. As we did that, Legal Services was able to move into virtual environments for the majority of our staff, but we also were able to continue to provide direct services to clients who were coming into new types of crises as a result of the pandemic. Many programs were also able, while juggling the move to this virtual environment, programs were able to come up with innovative ways to continue to reach clients. For example, certain programs implemented hotlines, new hotlines to respond to COVID-19 issues. And there were also programs who moved what were before in-person legal clinics to virtual legal clinics to ensure that services could still be provided to Minnesotans. As we did this, we noticed that the pandemic was disproportionately harming our communities that we serve. It didn't take long for these new obstacles to reveal themselves. Clients were without internet access, technology, and transportation. If they had phones, the phones didn't allow them to fill out court forms or to provide us with critical documents to help in our advocacy and even appear for court. Access to justice became even more about actual access because the digital divide now put the virtual justice system even further out of reach for our clients.
So to respond to what we saw in the work we were doing, what we were hearing from the communities we serve, and what we recognized in how we needed to be proactive in making justice possible was a need. And that need became a vision for us. And out of that vision, we crafted a proposal to help us develop the technological infrastructure to deliver representation healthily and safely to the communities we serve. We proposed additional funding through the CARES Act distribution from the state of Minnesota to support the development of a legal kiosk network where people could go to access our services and resources to learn about their rights. We developed additional upgrades to our award-winning lawhelpmn.org website, which is an amazing resource that's utilized by over 500,000 Minnesotans to learn about their rights every year. We also are implementing and deploying a fleet of justice buses, which are vehicles that we are converting to mobile civil legal aid offices to reach hard to reach communities throughout the state, particularly in greater Minnesota. And we also secured support for some emergency response services in some of the critical areas of civil legal need that we see, that we have been seeing in our work. So all told, we received over $3.2 million in CARES Act funding to build this infrastructure and system to continue to be able to deliver the critical services that we deliver to the communities we serve statewide.
We want to take a moment to really highlight the work that was done by Civil Legal Aid to implement the legal kiosks that Drew mentioned. So the legal kiosks are portals to accessing legal services. They're computer stations where there's a printer and a scanner, and they're hosted at community partners across the entire state. We worked swiftly in November to be able to partner with community members and others providing services to host the legal kiosks so people could access technology and access our services. We were able to deploy in 2 months, 246 legal kiosks so far. And there is a legal kiosk placed currently in 68 out of Minnesota's 87 counties. These kiosks are allowing folks to have direct legal services with legal aid programs. It allows them to appear for court and allows them to have meaningful access to the justice system. And we're very excited about the opportunity and the partnerships that we've had with our community partners that are hosting these excellent kiosks.
And while we are taking all of these steps to respond to the emergency that's been visited upon Minnesotans by the COVID-19 pandemic, we are also planning for the future. As we discussed earlier, we are forced to turn away more than half of the people who come to us for help. So there are critical legal cases where we know that the court faces backlogs of evictions, consumer debt collection matters, and other critical civil legal cases that affect people's most basic shelter needs and financial security. So what we are doing right now is working collaboratively with the judicial branch in districts around the state to do calendar coordination planning to ensure that legal aid has a presence to help support as many people as possible who face the prospect of eviction and homelessness when the statewide eviction moratorium is lifted. We are also working to coordinate volunteer presence and volunteer attorneys to help us with the cases that we see as critical legal needs that will emerge as more court activities pick up in the coming weeks and months throughout 2021. And we are continuing to connect with our communities to do outreach. And critically, we are always thinking about holistic legal services and how we can connect families and individuals who need our help to resources to help them solve their problems. So for example, to connect with emergency financial assistance or other programs available to pay rent so they can avoid eviction and the collateral consequences of facing an eviction court filing or the collateral consequences of homelessness. So we're doing all this planning now as we're implementing the infrastructure that we've created and the vision that we had about connecting with our client communities.
We'd like to end our presentation by leaving you with a client story. So this is an example of a type of case that civil legal service programs see, and it's specifically one from 2020. It's about family safety, security, protection from violence, stability for children, maintaining housing, and the impact the pandemic had on a survivor of domestic abuse and her children. So a client contacted legal aid to ask for help because her abuser had filed an order for protection against her. She already had one against him. But in turn, this order for protection removed her from their jointly leased apartment. She was contesting this order against him, but because of the pandemic, she couldn't get a court date for at least 30 days because the courts had to limit their activity due to the pandemic. She had none of her children's important belongings, none of their clothes, their beds, their backpacks, despite the fact that the order actually allowed law enforcement to assist her in obtaining those belongings. Because of the pandemic, there was no other avenue for her to get any relief, like in a family court, until the OFP was resolved. So legal aid stepped in. Legal aid filed a lockout case in housing court to order damages against the landlord and her abuser for illegally keeping her out of her property to get her family's belongings. Legal aid represented the client in a remote Zoom trial, which actually ended in an agreement, not only to return her belongings, but to pay her damages because of what she incurred as a result of the lockout. Without this action, there would have been no other way for the client to retrieve her basic belongings that were so critical to her and her family, and money to assist them with expenses during the pandemic. The client was able to escape an abusive relationship with a protective order while she's still contesting her abuser's order. But there's good news. She did learn that he has probably left the state, which provides her with more security, knowing that he will hopefully leave her and her family alone going forward. Legal aid was able to help her navigate a challenging system to find a solution when the pandemic impacted her ability to do so on her own.
And that story summarizes what we do at Legal Aid in Minnesota and how we identify the critical needs of our clients and deliver representation services to give them a chance at justice. With that, Dori and I want to welcome your questions and thank you again, Chair Becker Finn, and to the whole committee for having us here today, inviting us and giving us a chance to give you this high-level overview of civil legal services. And we shared our contact information so you can reach out as you reflect upon what you've heard today, but we would love to entertain your questions right now for the balance of our time.
Yeah, thank you so much for that presentation. We do have some questions. First, I will go to Vice Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to our presenters, not only for your presentations today, but for the important work you do for Minnesotans. And I have two questions. My first question is related to a slide that Mr. Schaefer shared with us regarding civil legal services funding. And I think it said 23% was other government. And I was first curious what that was. Is that grant money or where is that? What's accounting for that? And then my second question is really related almost to the story you just shared with us. And that's, I'm curious to know if you track the clients you serve, if they've been victims of violent crime. Obviously, if you're working with a domestic violence victim, you know that. But, you know, other victims that have experienced trauma could maybe not be able to go to work and they lose their job and then they're facing eviction. And so there might be a whole other host of consequences for those victims of crime. And I'm just curious if you ask them, if you know how many victims that you're actually serving.
Mr. Schaefer.
Chair Becker-Finn, thank you. Vice Chair Moeller, those are both great questions. The first one regarding the pie chart and the funding, the other government funding is generally grant funding. It comes from the federal government. It comes from state government. It comes in some cases from county government or city government for all of us. So it's very diverse in terms of the nature of what the specific grants support, but they're generally restricted to targeted activities that have been identified as public needs. Pivoting to your second question, actually we do as a system, some of us receive grant funding specifically through the Department of Justice federally to help crime victims. And so we do have special programs in some of our field offices where we are connecting specifically with people who have civil legal problems that arise out of being victims of crimes or survivors of abuse and horrors that are visited upon vulnerable people in the communities we serve. So we do have some information that we track for those specific grants that we would be happy to share with you and the committee to let you know about some of the work we're doing or even some of the stories of that work. And we also recognize and, you know, really want to highlight for all of you with your role that there is not as clear of a delineation between the criminal legal system and the civil legal system as many people believe. There are people who do have interactions with the criminal legal system who then have civil legal problems that arise out of those interactions. And we recognize that. And we have, you know, one of our core priorities is protecting survivors of family violence and abuse and helping those people be able to achieve justice in the civil legal system as they face their interactions with the criminal justice system as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Schaefer. And if you could provide that information to our committee administrator, we can certainly send that out to committee members. Vice Chair Moeller, any follow-up?
No, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Next, we have Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I also have two questions. I would like to thank you all for being here. I really appreciate this information. My questions are, in a situation where somebody seeks services but is unable to be serviced, if there's just not enough people or, you know, we don't have the capacity, what happens to those individuals? Where do they go? What happens after that? And then my second question is, I understand that pro bono is an aspect of civil legal services that's really important. How do you folks feel about mandatory pro bono, either mandatory pro bono itself, like the state of Florida has done, or mandatory reporting on pro bono?
Mr. Schaefer or Ms. Strait, whoever would like to take those questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. So I'll answer your first question first. What happens when somebody asks for civil legal services, but because of resources, we're unable to provide them with services? So all the organizations that you saw in our presentation coordinate their infrastructure to ensure that if somebody is seeking services and one program does not have the capacity to provide that, can we make a meaningful referral to another organization to ensure that somebody can get the highest level of service possible. So we have worked hard over the last 3 to 4 years on coordinating our infrastructure to ensure that we are able to do that. We utilize LawHelpMN, but behind the scenes, we are working through something called LOON, Legal Organizations Online Network, where we're constantly updating our capacity and ability to provide direct services to individuals. If we're unable to provide individual with a referral where they can get direct services, then our Law Help MN website, which we encourage you all to take a look at, is a wonderful place for clear information designed specifically for the communities that we're serving and all the poverty law areas that we know folks are looking for help. So I hope, does that answer your first question?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Okay, number two, asking about our view on mandatory pro bono, which I think is a bit of a controversial topic amongst the legal world. Recently, we were able to work in partnership with the Bar Association, the Minnesota State Bar Association, and members of our Access to Justice Committee to work towards a resolution to have actually uniform reporting be mandated for volunteer attorneys. So we're able to know if attorneys are meeting their ethical obligation of hours per year for pro bono work. And that really was a significant shift and took quite a bit of time for all of us to be able to work together to achieve. But we are quite glad to see that we're having folks report that information. Now, there's been a variety of studies on whether or not mandatory pro bono is effective for trying to address the justice gap. And, you know, if you look at other states, there's certainly a lot of benefits to making sure that people are coming in and making pro bono a mandatory part of their practice. But there's also the issues that you come across where there needs to be enough resources to be able to train and ensure that private attorneys are equipped to provide those types of services. If you have individuals that only practice transactional law, are they going to be able to be adequately trained to provide ethical representation to the clients that we're serving? So it would take more resources to be able to ensure that if we mandate pro bono, that everybody is able to come to the table and ethically represent the clients that we're serving.
All right, thank you. And we have 3 minutes. Representative Long is going to get the last question, and Representative Feist or any others, I encourage you to follow up directly and certainly let me know if you do have questions. Representative Long, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. I think that you've highlighted the real importance of civil representation, and also, Mr. Schaefer, you mentioned that there's often a lot of overlap with criminal representation, and that these cases are no less important to clients' lives in many, many instances than criminal representation. Yet we know, too, that there is a pay gap between what civil lawyers get paid and starting even public defenders. I think the former presentation mentioned $66,000 as a starting salary for public defenders. My understanding is that for civil legal services, starting salaries average around $51,000, so $15,000 pay gap. And I'm just curious what that means for you all for recruitment and retention of good civil attorneys.
Mr. Schaefer, Ms. Streit, in 1 minute, please.
Chair Beckerfin, thank you. Representative Long, thank you so much for that question. And you're going to hear a lot more from us about that issue in our next presentation. I will just tell you that Dory and I wake up every day thinking about this problem. It is a crisis in civil legal aid nationally. It is a crisis for civil legal aid in Minnesota. We lose so many talented people who want to seek justice as a professional career goal. And since we start our attorneys at an average statewide of 50,335, we are behind the public defenders, and they're behind everybody else in the public interest, public sector, legal employers environment. So it means a lot to us to try to address that crisis that we experience every day. And we're going to talk a lot more about that with all of you when we come back. I really appreciate the attention to the issue because it is so important and it affects how we are able to deliver services to our clients statewide.
All right. Thank you very much, everybody, for your attention and your good questions today. With being on Zoom, we can't go over a couple minutes like we normally would be able to do in the committee room. And so with that, next week's agenda, we'll be hearing from the Department of Administration about Chapter 13 related to data practices. And we will also be hearing from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. So thank you very much to our presenters. This is really great information. And again, please follow up with the presenters if you do have additional questions. I know they are happy to answer our questions. And with that, we are adjourned.